Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dan Gretton. He's a writer, activist, and teacher. In 1983, he co-founded the pioneering political arts organization Platform in Cambridge, where he studied English literature, as well as working with Platform over many years on the human rights and environmental impacts of corporations. He's also developed radical initiatives in adult education and has lectured internationally on the subject of the desk killer. After more than a decade of research, aided by a major award from the Lannan Foundation, he embarked on the writing of I, You, We, Them. He currently divides his time between Northwest Wales and East London, where he shares his garden with a family of foxes. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thanks so much for the invitation, Derek.
So I thought that I, You, We, Them was one of the most extraordinary and important books that I've read. And I love how you deftly move from exploring some of the most important topics that it is possible to discuss today, and I'll leave what that topic is for you to discuss, with personal reflections, experiences. At times, it's almost, I mean, you talk about, and you do this extraordinary thing. I heard Linda Hogan decades ago said to me that one of the things she doesn't like about a lot of nature writers is that a nature writer can go to Yucatan and then they talk about themselves.
And yes.
You kind of did the opposite, that you took yourself to the sources, to the geography of, to the physical place of atrocities, but even though you talked about your own reflections, I never felt like you were talking about yourself, like you were simply going to Treblinka and talking about yourself.
Right.
Do you see the distinction I'm trying to make?
I totally do. And thank you very much for those kind words. I was very much aiming in the way I wrote this book. I mean, it's a massive project. It took more than 20 years of thought since I began the ideas on this in the late 90s, and about 10 years of actual writing. But I really was so keen in the writing of this that I didn't want to hammer the reader over the head with simply information, because there is enough disturbing information in the world, and I very, very much wanted to, my aim was to take the reader on the most extraordinary personal journey it's possible to make, so that I accompany the reader in this book. I'm not ramming stuff down people's throat. I'm gently leading us through a landscape together. That's the feeling I wanted to get from this. And, therefore, there's lots of personal reflection in here, but the personal reflections throughout these almost 1,000 pages are only there as a means of the reader thinking about their own lives, thinking about their own reflections, their own political thoughts. And I think that's a beautiful thing when you have that with a writer. It would be immodest of me to say whether or not I've completely succeeded in that, but I hope at least I've written it with that intent. I remember years ago, it was a great privilege of my life. The last sort of 15, 17 years of his life, I knew the wonderful writer and activist, John Berger, who became a friend, towards the end of his life. And I remember talking to John once about political writing, and he said something that was so brilliant. He said that he often has a problem reading writers that politically he agrees with. But I remember him screwing up his face and saying, "But Dan, they sometimes they don't leave any oxygen. There's no oxygen for the reader. It's like being on a crushed tube platform in London at rush hour. There's just, you're bombarded by information and you have to let the reader breathe." And so letting the reader breathe is what I hope I've done with I, You, We, Them. I hope I've achieved that But, you know, it's for the readers to decide.
Well, I think you have. And I'm sort of torn here as to whether we should explore that more or whether we should whether we should go with more of how you wrote it and the journey, or whether we should address an intriguing phrase that a lot of people may have not heard, which is the phrase desk killer. Mm. And which direction would you like to go?
Well, I think they're very indivisible, really, Derek. I think we're going to swing through these. We'll come back to things. I don't think it's going to be like I get the feeling it's not going to be like a linear conversation. So I just, because the way that this book is written is, it's, of course I'm not a feminist, but I think it's, I've been hugely informed by feminism in my life and my activism. So my grandmother, who's a key figure in this book, my mother, my sister, my sister-in-law, I come from a family of incredibly strong women and inspiring women. And so I think, you know, that's part of it. This making things very personal. The book is incredibly personal and it's also very vulnerable. And I think there's a subversion in writing with vulnerability in there, especially when you're writing about these massive historical and political subjects. I think there's a beautiful combination of seemingly paradoxical between the personal open way of writing and the very, very hard hitting political analysis in this book. So I'm happy to go in whichever direction, and we'll weave back. I'm sure we will.
Well, I think that we should lay the groundwork for people. I mean, what are desk killers? What's the point?
Okay. I started out on this journey about really when I was about 21 years old, and I saw a film that blew me away when I was just out of university at 1986. And I spent 2 days in a cinema in central London watching a 9.5-hour film about the Holocaust, Shoah by Claude Lanzmann. And that film changed my life. One part of that film in particular, the film, as some of your listeners will know, is probably the greatest film ever made about the Holocaust. It is simply the voices and the faces of perpetrators, victims, survivors, and bystanders, the witnesses. But one part of that film was remarkable. It showed a wet road going through the German industrial lands, where the factories are. And it showed a little lorry going through this landscape. And as the lorry went through this landscape, a voice read a memorandum which was sent by an SS officer to another SS officer in 1942, talking about the processing of 90,000 human beings. And in this memorandum, it was like two businessmen talking to each other. The language is terrifying. And it comes very early on in the book. I reproduce that memorandum. The language is almost entirely businesslike. There's almost no humanity, or certainly no empathy, in that letter. It's about how we can change the design of this van so that more people can successfully be gassed in these mobile gas chambers. And I was just staggered at what really staggered me, Derek, was that language could have been written any time between the 1940s and the 2000s. It was like, it was so modern. It was so bureaucratic. And I thought about the person who actually sat down and typed that out. And I thought about the person who received that message. And I thought, you can kill from your desk. You can devastate communities from your desk, from your computer. And then, of course, other experiences just followed on from there. And I was later, about 10 years later, I have to say, I didn't quite know what to do with that. It was so terrifying, that document. I didn't quite know what to do with it. And so I kind of put it at the back of my head for about 10 years. And then in the mid-90s, reports started to come through about what the oil company Shell were doing in Nigeria. And we in Platform began to work on that issue of kind of the human rights impacts of the oil companies by the stage we'd started doing this. But that particular disgrace, in terms of the total pollution and total despoliation of an entire landscape of the Niger Delta, that really got to me in 93, 94, 95. And of course, as you'll remember, Derek, and many of your listeners will remember, Shell and the Nigerian government became so terrified at the impact of the brilliant and inspiring campaigner Ken Sara Wiwa and the movement he'd set up called MOSOP to try and completely peacefully combat the total destruction of his country. Shell and the Nigerian government were so alarmed by that that there was a trial that followed on completely false charges. And Ken Sara Wiwa, this wonderful writer and activist who believed in Gandhian principles of nonviolence, he and eight of his colleagues were executed in November 1995. And that, to me, was another turning point, because I thought at that moment, that outrageous moment, where we found out the following day, on the 11th of November, which I'll never forget, hearing that news, I thought only about the people who were going into work as normal. They were the people. Of course, I also thought about the family of all the men who'd been executed. But I thought primarily I was just totally focused on how would you get up if you worked at Shell? How could you get up and go to work the next day? How would you drive into the Shell Centre in London and simply do your job, knowing that the activities of your corporation had pretty directly caused the deaths of not only, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people in Nigeria through the pollution and the fires and the gas flaring, but actually the immediate deaths, the executions of these nine men, these activists? How would you go on? How could you live with yourself? So those were absolutely formative in terms of thinking about the desk killer, the people who work in their offices. And then the final piece of the jigsaw, which, you know, we can talk about perhaps in more detail. The final piece of the jigsaw was a few years after that, I read Gita Sereny's remarkable book on Albert Speer, who was Hitler's architect and later became the armaments minister during the Second World War. And Sereny and Speer come back to this concept. It was a concept which leapt out at me from those pages, because the concept was compartmentalization. This was how it was possible to do all of those things. That was the kind of final piece in the jigsaw, really, that the Sereny book on Speer, because it became obvious that these perpetrators, these desk killers, can only do what they do because of doing something to their brains. And there's actually a quotation in the book, Sereny's book on Speer, that I'll just give you very briefly. It's Speer talking to Sereny. Hitler required us not only to compartmentalize our activities, but also our thinking. He insisted that each man should only think about his task and not be concerned with that of his neighbor. And I then thought, there has to be something written about this, about what we do in our heads as human beings and what perpetrators do, particularly with terrifying consequences. It is the key to all of this is compartmentalization. And that's really what I've been exploring for the last 20 years. And this is what the book is. The book comes back to this word again and again and again.
So define or explore compartmentalization, because I'm thinking, I'm wondering if you can also put the word context or decontextualization into your answer somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me give you an example or two examples. I think it's helpful. I much prefer kind of experiential thought rather than abstract thought. And what I mean by that is by looking at the lives of people rather than simply abstract ideas. And I want to read out something that will help enormously in what you've just asked. This is something Speer said later in his life, which is absolutely astonishing. If you think about, he was at the center of Hitler's government, absolutely central figure. But yet this is what he did in his mind. This is what he said. I felt myself to be Hitler's architect. Political events did not concern me. I felt there was no need for me to take any political positions at all. I was expected to confine myself to the job of building. The grotesque extent to which I clung to this illusion is indicated by a memorandum of mine to Hitler as late as 1944. The task I have to fulfill is an unpolitical one. I have felt at ease in my work only so long as my person and my work were evaluated solely by the standards of practical accomplishments. I mean, this is the man who was producing the armaments that allowed Germany to fight the Second World War, probably into 1944 and 45, causing an additional 10 to 15 million deaths in that final year of the war. And yet he thought his task was an unpolitical one, which is staggering, totally staggering. The other examples are, you know, people, I can give you many, but one that comes to mind is that John Brown, who was the chief executive of BP, in 2000, he gave, this is the head of a large transnational oil corporation. And he gave the most extraordinary series of lectures where he was basically reinventing himself as a kind of green pioneer. This is the head of an oil company that had caused catastrophic ecological damage across the world. And had contributed massively to, you know, fossil fuel production. And he has the astonishing compartmentalized mind to come up with a series of lectures, which the BBC broadcast. And it was called something like In Defense of the Earth. You know, I mean, those are just two examples that come to mind.
So my first degree was in engineering. It was in physics. It was mineral engineering physics. So it's physics with extra engineering and extra geology thrown in. And, you know, I'm thinking about the lorry comment and improving the design of a mobile killing van. And, that, there's the line about, because actually a correction in the weight distribution takes place automatically through the fact that the cargo, that is the people to be killed, in the struggle toward the back door during the operation always is preponderantly located there. So he's talking about fixing the engineering of the truck to take into account the fact that the cargo shift to the rear as they're struggling to get out. And that the engineering mindset is just so interesting to me in terms of that decontextualization. It doesn't matter whether you're building a crematoria or a slaughterhouse or a church. I mean, the same engineering principles apply. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true with bureaucracies in general. I feel like I'm sort of muddling this question. So can you rescue me?
No. I think you're absolutely on the right lines. That particular memorandum, it only focuses on the problem solving, the technical challenges. There is one reference in the whole two pages of that memorandum, which hints at human beings, and it talks about. It doesn't term them as human beings. It's about overloading the front axle, but in fact the balance is automatically restored because the merchandise during the operation displays a natural tendency to push to the rear doors and is mainly found lying there at the end of the operation. So this idea of the load, the cargo, the merchandise, so the human beings have already been entirely depersonalized. And that's one of the ways that then mass killing can happen is when, of course, the humanity is taken away from people and they are then can be regarded as abstractions or things or objects. I think that's a very important part of that.
And likewise, timber companies can simply talk in terms of millions of board feet as opposed to, you know, native forests. Oil companies can talk about millions of barrels of oil as opposed to, and what would the term be for, what has happened to the Niger Delta itself? Let's leave the humans out of it for a second and just the Niger Delta. What would be the bureaucratic term for, would that just be spillage? Would that be wastage?
They talk about all of those things, spillage. The oil pipeline spills. The language is obscene. We know it from war, the way politicians talk about war, the way corporations talk about the damage they do. There's an entire industry, isn't there? The whole public relations industry is designed to barbarize our language and, to use euphemisms all the time. I mean, I think I just want to backtrack fractionally, Derek. There's something else that Shvia said, when he was imprisoned after the war. And at one point, this is really fascinating because, he had 3 years imprisoned at Nuremberg. He got a 20-year sentence in the trial, in the immediate post-war trial with the major criminals. And many people felt he should have been executed, but he escaped that. I think mainly because the Americans and the British wanted to see if he could be used in some way, post-war when the Cold War was on its way. But Speer said something remarkable when he was talking to a French priest who became he actually, for the first time in his life, he was asked to become reflective and really explore kind of intellectual ideas in a way that he'd never had done before in his life and look at the nature of his responsibility for what he had been part of. And this remarkable French priest called Casalis spent 3 years meeting him every week and giving him kind of a huge reading list, and they would have conversations trying to get at Speer's real responsibility. And in one of these conversations, Speer admitted to Casalis this. He said an American who was interrogating me said that I loved machines more than people. And that line, I loved machines more than people, it suddenly struck me was something very, there was something very important there, because that's talking about a love of the abstract, a love of engineering, a love of mathematics, a love of all of these kinds of things that actually take us away from the human being. And when Speer is confronted with the human being, particularly with the eyes of a human being, he is suddenly in a different place. And he visited in December 1943, he visited a terrifying, it was under a mountain in the Harz Mountains. The Nazis were building the V2 rockets, which they thought would help them win the war. The conditions there were, he went to a place called Dora in late 1943, and Speer spent most of the war years in his office in Berlin, you know, writing documents at his desk, you know, the great organizer. But this was a time he actually went to a place of horror. And he described that as a moment in his life that was a turning point, because for the first time, he could see the bodies piled up at the side as of the entrance. He could see the eyes of the slave laborers, his own slave laborers. He looked into their eyes. And that was terrifying for Speer, because this man who loved abstract systems, who loved mathematics and engineering and all of those things that you were talking about, he loved technical challenges and problem solving. For the first time, he could see, well, maybe not for the first time, but for this particular time, he saw the devastation that his work was causing. And that was a fundamental change for him. He had a total physical and nervous breakdown for the following 6, 7, 8 weeks. He was in hospital. He said afterwards, this was the moment he began to see Hitler as insane. Now that might be self-serving of Speer, you know, of Speer. That might be him trying to escape responsibility. But I think there was a massive change that happened late 43, early 1944. And that's because he saw the eyes, not the abstract systems.
So I have like 5 responses to some of the things you've said, and I'm just going to throw all these out, and then, okay, and then you can either choose one or you can shape them all, whatever.
Okay.
So first, this makes me think of how in the Einsatzgruppen, who were, for listeners, they were, they would often shoot Jews or Russians face to face. There was a tremendous technical problem that they ran into, which was overwhelming alcoholism, because it was so horrible to be killing people face to face. And that was one of the reasons that they designed the mobile killing vans.
Exactly.
One of the reasons was to, protect the psyches of the Einsatzgruppen and from what they were doing. Okay. That's one thing.
Exactly right. Yeah.
The next thing is, this makes me think of Eric Fromm's extraordinary book, The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, where he talks about, how necrophilia, the way he defines it, is a preference for machines. You know, when we think of necrophilia, usually we think of somebody at a mortuary, some very nasty person at a mortuary having sex or raping a dead body. But, but his necrophilia is, or the way he defines it, is a preference for machine life over human, over not human life, but over biological life, over real life, whether it doesn't matter whether it's trees or humans. Mm. That's the second thing. The third thing is, I want for us to make sure to not keep all of this. And you have done a wonderful job of keep bringing this forward to oil companies, et cetera. but I want for us to make sure we know, we all know explicitly that this is not safely confined to the dustbin of, you know, 1932, 33 to 1945, that this was not a one-off, but, no. but still is going. And the next thing I want to bring up is that before we started the official interview, we were having a delightful conversation where we were talking about everything from the end of Empire to last night. There was a quote presidential, should I put that word around, quotes around the word presidential, debate between Biden and Trump, which was either horrifying and or hilarious, I guess, depending on how abstract we want to be. I mean, it was just, it was, what's the value neutral term? It was something.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm just throwing all of that stew out there. And now I would like for you to do whatever you want with any of it.
Okay. Well, let's start at the last part there.
And I also want to bring up End of Empire. We were having a delightful conversation about the End of Empire too before we started. So anywhere you want to go with any of that.
Okay. Wow. I think I'll start towards the end, because I, as I said to you just before we started, I am a political obsessive, and I actually took a piece of paper last night. It was, the debate happened my time, 2 a.m., 2 in the morning. So I stayed up. I'm a night owl anyway, but I thought I'll stay up for this. And I actually took a piece of paper, and I wrote at the top of the paper, Biden sociopath debate. Now, the reason I use that term is a very, very precise medical term that I use. I never refer to that man by name, the man who has phenomenal power in your country, by name, because I think he should be called the sociopath, because that is what Tony Schwartz, who worked with him on his major breakthrough in the 1980s, which was a book called The Art of the Deal. That's what Tony Schwartz decided he was in the months they spent together. And he wrote actually a brilliant article for The New Yorker, which was called The Sociopath. And I think that article has now been taken down, which is quite interesting. I can't find it online anymore, but I definitely read that in The New Yorker in this time of year, September, October, just before the 2016 election. And we start with language. I don't think the man is a criminal necessarily, but I think he should be in a medical institution where he can be safe from others and safe from himself. I think he's phenomenally dangerous. Anyway, I started this with a blank piece of paper, Biden sociopath debate, and I wrote not a single word on that piece of paper. I was completely stunned, because what stunned me was there was no debate. And I think it was quite deliberate of the sociopath that he didn't want to engage in debate. He wanted to try, and he did it to some extent successfully. He wanted to disrupt the whole procedure. I was absolutely astounded that for such an important, seemingly important event, you could have a moderator from Fox News. I was astounded by that. And he did a terrible job. He didn't chair that debate. He didn't moderate it. But to have somebody from Fox News, that's not a neutral party. That alarmed me. Anyway, so we have to start with the language we use. You know, I think if you want to know why all across the world we are in political crisis at the moment, to show even a minute or 2 minutes of that disgraceful supposed debate last night, you'd have everything you needed about why we are in a terrifying position. They're not equivalent, those people, by the way, but to have two white men in their 70s, you know, engaged like that. It was so educational about why we are facing the most profound crisis. But I think, we have to start with language, changing the language. John Berger had a wonderful phrase which came in a discussion he had, an exchange of letters he had round about the year 2000 with Subcomandante Marcos, who was then really massively involved in a struggle for autonomy in southeastern Mexico in the mountains. And there's a wonderful exchange of letters they wrote, and Marcos said, "The planet today is the battlefield of a fourth world war. The third was the so-called Cold War. The aim of the belligerents is the conquest of the entire world through the market. The arsenals are financial. There are nevertheless millions of people being maimed or killed every moment. Thanks to computers and the technological revolution, the financial markets operating from their offices, unanswerable to nobody but themselves, have been imposing their laws and worldview on the planet as a whole. Globalization is merely the totalitarian extension of the logic of the finance markets to all aspects of life. Meanwhile, 90% of the women and men on the planet live with the jagged pieces that do not fit this puzzle." And then John said this, which for me is an absolute definition of hope. And this is why we have to change the language. "The first step towards building an alternative world has to be a refusal of the world picture implanted in our minds. Another space is vitally necessary. First, a horizon has to be discovered, and for this we have to re-find hope against all the odds of what the new order pretends and perpetrates. The act of resistance means not only refusing to accept the absurdity of the world picture offered us, but denouncing it. And when hell is denounced from within, it ceases to be hell." So that action of refusing to accept the absurdity of the world picture offered us, that is probably the most important political action we can take, I think. And so that means if you refuse to accept the absurdity of the world picture offered us, we do not accept the language, any of the language that is used by those in power and who abuse power. We start by not accepting the language. Wasn't it Audre Lorde who said that magnificent phrase, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house"? Yeah? I mean, that's important. They may allow us temporarily to beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about genuine change. Audre Lorde, absolutely right. John Berger, absolutely right. We have to start in a different place. And I'm afraid to say a lot of activism, for my money, that's a bad phrase to use, a lot of activism does not pay enough attention to language. The language is absolutely critical. That's because that's where political change begins. So to come to backtrack on your questions. Yeah, the Eric Fromm is also very, very important. And I will follow that reference up. I've read a lot of his work, but that preference for machines over biological life. I mean, when you were talking about that, Derek, all I could think of was in the last 20 years, in the time that my nephews and nieces have grown up, their lives have been totally dominated by screens and by images and by social media in a way that our generation was not. Absolutely not. You know, and I think that's an enormous problem. And I think going back to Eric Fromm would be really, really instructive. And I will definitely follow that Anatomy of Human Destructiveness up after we've had this conversation. you're absolutely right about, I didn't write this book as a historical book. There's huge amounts of historical information in there, but that's not the point of it. The point is all the time to bring it back to our world. So for instance, there's whole sections in the book about the way, drones are used in warfare and operated 8,000 miles away from where they're actually killing people, from calm and quiet offices in Nevada, where the operators of those death machines can then go back, drive back 35, 40 minutes on their commute to their families. And they've helped to kill people during the day, and they drive back and they're clean. They think they're clean. Of course they're not. I mean, it's yes, one other thing to say, you know, we always have to remember in this that to come back to the climate catastrophe we're facing, which is by far the most important issue in our world. And that line of Utah Phillips, which is a wonderful line that he came out with years ago, the great musician and activist. And he said, the planet is not dying. It is being killed. And the people who are killing it have names and addresses. And we need to hold those people to account, every single one of them.
That would be a delightful place to end, but we're not going to.
Good.
I'm thinking about I'm thinking a few things. One of them, as you have come to expect by now, one of them is Robert J. Lifton talked about doubling and how you could have somebody run a death camp, but be a good husband and father. Mm-hmm. And they would be split. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that most of the death killers do not perceive themselves as committing atrocities.
Absolutely right. Totally right. I talk about Robert J. Lifton's work in the book. There's a very extensive section on the way doctors, hundreds and hundreds of doctors who, of course, take the Hippocratic Oath for the protection of life, they became absolutely embedded with the SS, and particularly so at Auschwitz, where dozens of them worked in laboratories and on experiments with prisoners. And of course, in also key people involved in the selection of who would live and who would die when people arrived, particularly at Birkenau. So you're completely right about that. And the doubling. These were, of course, you know, highly educated, intelligent men who had gone into a caring profession and were in through a series of many, many steps. They, you know, were involved in some of the most barbaric things that have ever happened on this planet. But to bring it right up to date, what about this is an extraordinary thing that happened a couple of weeks ago on BBC Radio. A presenter on a national BBC radio program was interviewing Tony Blair's former publicity chief called Alistair Campbell. And I was actually listening to this at home, doing the washing up in my kitchen here in Wales. And I couldn't quite believe what I was hearing, Derek, because Alistair Campbell had a book out, and his book was about people who are suffering from depression and his own depression, and he was coming across very sympathetically, talking about his empathy for his brother who had died early, and about his own struggles with depression. And then the presenter, who was called Nihal, he then put this into the conversation. And he said this, Nihal, people have been in positions of power such as yourself in government. I don't know if you've read Dan Gretton's book, Are You We Them? I strongly suggest you do. It's a fantastic book. Journeys Beyond Evil, it's called. Alistair Campbell. Okay. Nihal. It talks about the phenomenon of the deskiller, the people who from their desks do things that result in, you know, there was the person who planned the train routes to Auschwitz, right? Alistair Campbell. Mm-hmm. Nihal. Then there was Eichmann who turned up in Jerusalem and said, I was just following orders. Alistair Campbell. Mm-hmm. Nihal. And they managed to distance themselves by saying, and I believe in your diaries the word Nuremberg comes up. Someone says to you, oh, that's interesting. That's what they said in Nuremberg. Alistair Campbell. Mm-hmm. Nihal. Do you have to dissociate yourself for that? Because otherwise, considering you suffer from depression, the pain of trying to understand that the things you went out to sell to the press and other people, stakeholders as it were, contributed to hundreds and thousands of people dying is almost a burden that's too much to bear. Alistair Campbell. Mm. But again, I think what you're doing there, what I was saying earlier, it's not fair. Nihal. Well, desk killers, by definition, never think it's them. I mean, that exchange. And I'm doing the washing up at home. And I'm thinking, yes, yes, at last, this term, the desk killers, is coming into public discussion. You know, mainstream discussion on national radio station. And, yeah, so there we are. Talk about doubling. With Alistair Campbell, he comes across as a very humane, empathetic man, and yet what he did through his work created a situation where the Iraq war was possible, and that total barbaric result, hundreds of thousands of dead. And he defended himself later in the interview. What I mean is that anyone who doesn't understand the background to this is listening and thinking that I made that decision. And then the presenter said brilliantly, no, you didn't make that decision, but you sold that decision. Now, nobody has ever before been able to get any kind of, nobody's been able to actually get Alistair Campbell to admit to anything in that way. And it's fascinating to me that there he is. He wanted to sell his book and talk about depression and how empathetic he was. And he ended up not having a word to say back to the interviewer about his responsibility for the Iraq war.
So we have that gives me, I don't have a lot of respect for a lot of journalists, but that actually gives me some respect for that journalist because that was brilliant.
Perfect. Brilliant. Yeah.
So we have about 3 or 4 minutes left and mm-hmm. as always, a couple directions. One of them is just three of them. One is, can you talk about the next part of this book? Two, sorry to give you so much to do in 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. Two, what do you want people to do generically with the information that they gain from your excellent book? And three, one of the things I love about the story that you just told is for me, the story you just told is precisely for me, the point of writing books is because you writing that book gave that journalist the ammunition, the understanding, we can use whichever language we want, gave the tools to be able to push the discussion in directions that would not have been, you gave him the language that he might not have had 5 years previously, means he would not have been able to do that particular interview 5 years previously. So for me, that's how social change occurs.
Mm. Wow. Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. That's very, very interesting. Yeah. I mean, okay, I'll deal with those three in the order you asked them, Derek. I mean, first of all, this perhaps mad project of mine This 997 pages is just the first half of Are You We Them? So the other, the second volume has been written. It's in two books, like this first one was two books. They are what I explore in the second part of the book, second part of this volume is I look at the most extraordinary political philosopher of the last 50 or 60 years, Hannah Arendt. We go in detail as we see through her eyes, her looking at Eichmann, at the Eichmann trial in the early 1960s in Israel. But we bring in almost everything to that story of Hannah Arendt and Eichmann. So that's part of it. I also travel back to Auschwitz in book three, and I look in probably more detail than anybody, historian or otherwise, has ever looked at the most powerful company in the world in the 1940s, which was this vast chemical corporation, IG Farben. And IG Farben, later we know in our world now, it was split into companies like Bayer, Herxt, BASF and Agfa. So it was an enormously powerful corporation. And in the 1940s, they literally took part in a public-private partnership with the SS. And they created their own private concentration camp in the east of Auschwitz, and where 30,000 slave laborers died, creating this insane synthetic fuels and synthetic fuel plant. And so I explore the meaning of that collusion, what the meaning of that collusion was. And then in the final part of the book, it moves much more towards an exploration of empathy and it doesn't provide answers, that would be too glib, but it opens up possibilities in terms of neurological research being done today, looking at empathy and how we can work against the death killers. And really, really, I think that's such an important ending to, that's where book four ends. What I want the book to do, I actually wanted, this phrase has been in my mind a lot the last year or two since, last year particularly since the book was published in the UK. In November, it was published in America at the end of July. But it's all throughout this last year, this phrase has been in my head. I would like the book to work like a benevolent bomb. I know that seems an absurd phrase, but I quite like it. Benevolent bomb, because I want it to have a kind of explosive force under our societies. I want it to disrupt, I want it to subvert totally, but I want it to do it in a benevolent way, obviously not a destructive way as an actual bomb would do. So benevolent bomb, I want it to do. And I think what you've just said there about the story I just told about the interview, you're totally right. That is the entire point of writing. It's about giving people language or ideas that they may have thought of and never quite dared to articulate, or giving people new directions to question everything, to question the foundation of America built on total genocide. I mean, if you want to know why America is as totally fucked up as it is over race, as it is at the moment, you know, more than probably any other country in the world, you cannot look at that discussion without looking at the total extermination of the indigenous peoples, you know, and I look at colonialism in many countries. I want us to ask questions after question after question of everybody in power. Another hugely important figure in the book, is my father, who was a classicist, and my father had an enormous love of Socrates. And Socrates, of course, his mantra was question everything, even question me, who is now telling you to question everything. So that's what I'd like people to take away.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dan Gretton. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.